The first indication of just how committed the CIA was to blocking Wilson's Erlikon initiative came from the Pentagon. While Wilson was still in Pakistan, General Richard S. Stilwell, in charge of all the Pentagon's black activities, had stormed into the congressman's office demanding to speak to the administrative assistant. When Charles Simpson appeared, the very first words out of Stilwell's mouth were, "Who the hell is Charlie Wilson and what the hell does he think he's doing with the Afghan program?" The retired general was not even trying to be diplomatic as he laid down the law to Simpson. No one had asked Wilson for the appropriation, and even if the agency had additional funds, it wouldn't be able to use them effectively. Finally, he barked, Wilson should know that the $40 million was scheduled to come out of existing Pentagon funds, and he was in a position to block that. His parting wisdom was that the congressman had no business sticking his nose into operational details of a covert program. Wilson was not overly distressed when Simpson reported the encounter. A mere general could never frustrate one of the key defense appropriators. But a far more effective coalition was mobilizing, and it took Wilson a while to figure out who the real enemy was. He would have been well served to follow what had been happening at the other end of the Capitol, where an able and well-liked U.S. senator was also running into trouble when he sought to expand support for the Mujahideen. There was only one other serious champion of the Mujahideen during this time, a liberal Democratic senator named Paul Tsongas, who managed, in spite of ferocious opposition from the Reagan White House, to win passage of a congressional resolution calling for increased support for the Mujahideen. It remains something of a puzzle why Tsongas and Wilson, two ingrained liberals, emerged as the only early champions of the Afghan rebels. No one in those days would have dreamed of calling the Reagan administration soft on communism, but Charlie Wilson couldn't find anyone in the administration who seemed to want anything more than a safe, bleeding campaign. For him, Afghanistan had become a political mystery. Why was it that Ronald Reagan could invade Grenada, commission Star Wars, bypass Congress to keep his secret Contra war alive, and frighten everyone by branding the Soviets the evil empire? Yet when Wilson made his move to up the ante and counter the most egregious Soviet aggression, he met only resistance. Stilwell had at least been up front. No one else was. According to Wilson, the CIA initially blamed the State Department for the resistance. The Pentagon said it was the fault of the Office of Management and Budget, which was refusing to release the $40 million. But the OMB people Wilson spoke to said the Pentagon had refused to take the money out of existing naval funds as the bill had specified. The reason for the delay was congressional confusion. At first, Wilson thought he might be up against a turf battle led by the State Intelligence Committee, whose staffers were up in arms about the way he had usurped their role. Ordinarily, a CIA program can be funded only if it is first authorized by the two intelligence committees. Having bypassed that step, Wilson now found himself having to make the process legitimate. Because the money had to be taken from existing Pentagon funds, reprogrammed, he had pursued the chairman and ranking members of the House and Senate Armed Services Committee, as well as intelligence, to sign off on the bill. The House was no problem. Mel Price, the chairman of the Armed Services Committee, was so senile that Charlie got a staffer to sign for him. Lee Hamilton, the highly respected House Intelligence Committee chairman, appeared ready to block the bill until Wilson warned his old ally, Speaker Tip O'Neill, that he was prepared to take the floor and accuse the Democrats of selling freedom down the river. It was Wilson's way of cashing in an IOU, and O'Neill put in a call to Hamilton, who dropped his opposition. That left the Senate, a distasteful place for any congressman to have to go hat in hand. Nevertheless, the Texan booked an appointment with Senator Sam Nunn, who surprised Wilson by quickly signing off. Nunn would turn out to be a quiet and forceful backer of this and all future Afghan programs. Wilson's next stop was Senator Moynihan, the ranking Democrat on intelligence, whom he lured out of a hearing. Charlie soon won his approval. The last remaining obstacle was the chairman of the Intelligence Committee, Barry Goldwater. Here, Wilson figured he had a certain in if he dared to use it. The senator's son, Barry Jr., had been a target of the same federal drug prosecution effort that had hounded him, and Charlie had always suspected that the senior Goldwater had been helpful in getting the case dismissed. So he took a gamble on a joke. "Both Barry and I were subjected to police brutality by Rudolph Giuliani and the Justice Department," he said with that infectious, rumbling laugh of his. and Goldwater told him to come into the office. "I know this was turf trespassing on my part," Wilson began, "but what we want to do is shoot down the Russian helicopters." Goldwater was an old Air Force pilot and a legendary anti-communist, and Charlie told him it was unacceptable for the greatest power on Earth not to give the Mujahideen an effective anti-aircraft weapon. Wilson was at his patriotic best, and he struck a responsive chord. In the 1960s, Goldwater's best-selling political manifesto, The Conscience of a Conservative, had set the conservative revolution in motion with its warning of dire consequences should the United States fail to act boldly and counter the Soviet menace. "Well, fuck the turf," the silver-haired senator said after listening to Charlie's appeal. Wilson realized that this congressional rebellion had been much ado about nothing, and that his real problems were not at state, the Pentagon, OMB, or on the Hill. They were coming from Langley. Wilson had thought that the CIA's main stumbling block must be money, and on this point he was sympathetic. His Democratic colleagues in the House had been so antagonistic to the CIA for so long that it was no wonder the agency didn't believe Wilson when he said money was no object. He had assumed that his $40 million gift would have established his bona fides with the CIA's leaders and encouraged some bolder thinking. Even after the war was over, Wilson would always remain convinced that Director Casey supported everything he was trying to do for the Mujahideen. The director was the last of the adventuring World War II heroes, a man who had been responsible for dropping spies behind the lines in Germany, and who talked Wilson's Churchillian language of standing up to tyranny. And Charlie had witnessed Casey's emotional response to Mojaddedi that day in the White House when the Afghan leader had turned to Mecca in prayer. As the months wore on and the agency surfaced as the problem, Wilson chose to believe that it was the bureaucrats who were poisoning Casey's thoughts. In Wilson's mind, there was no question who was responsible for this cynical policy of leaving the Afghans helpless in the field. It had to be Charles Galligan Cogan, a man no one had elected, who thought he should decide what the United States would and would not do for the Afghans. In later years, while affiliated with Harvard's John F. Kennedy School of Government, Cogan would acknowledge that the CIA had overestimated the Soviet Union, and that, in retrospect, the rigid concerns about concealing the American hand to prevent Soviet retaliation had been exaggerated. But back in 1984, he believed that the way to run a U.S. proxy war was the way the CIA had always done it. If these two men had met when Cogan was starting off at the agency, Wilson might have found much to admire. Certainly back in the early 1960s, he wouldn't have branded the handsome young case officer a wimp. At 28, Cogan was the deputy station chief in the Congo. There, he ran South African mercenaries, sent Bay of Pigs veteran pilots on interdiction missions against Soviet-backed troops, and rescued nuns from savagery. During this time, headquarters was even bold enough to send assassins down to murder Patrice Lumumba. In the Congo, Chuck Cogan was no pantywaist, nor had he been while serving in the Sudan. But gradually, it is said, he developed airs. Perhaps it began in India, where he learned to ride horses and play polo, or perhaps when he won the patronage of Archie Roosevelt, and later the friendship of Morocco's King Hassan and Jordan's King Hussein. After 30 years in the agency, Cogan was the perfect choice for royals, but the wrong man for Charlie Wilson.
"So how many reasons have you come up with this week not to do anything, Mr. Coburn?" Wilson asked Cogan.
A week after their unpleasant last encounter, Wilson did not yet understand that the agency's leadership was united in its opposition to the Oerlikon. He proceeded to heap abuse on Cogan.
"You just don't give a shit about the Mujahideen, do you? The Viet Cong shot down 2,000 of our helicopters in Vietnam. How many have you shot down?"
Cogan had initiated this meeting. The agency was obligated to spell out how it wanted to spend the non-Oerlikon portion of the appropriation, and Cogan wanted to know how much flexibility it had. Wilson says,
"He came in to talk to me about the boots and blankets and shit, and I said, 'Fuck this, Coburn, what about the fucking guns?'"
Cogan said they were initiating several steps.
"Yes," Wilson yelled back, "and the fucking helicopters are killing people right this second while you are studying. As best as I can tell, you ain't got but two things to study because that language says a cannon."
Wilson then spelled out the choices to him.
"Either buy the Oerlikon or the ZSU 23mm Soviet gun."
It was the only other applicable canon. Only at one point did Avrakatos intervene, suggesting that the Erlikon would force the Afghans to defend fixed positions instead of relying on more effective hit-and-run guerrilla tactics.
"We'd just end up losing the Erlikons, which cost $100,000 each, or the Afghans would all die trying to defend them."
Wilson was completely unimpressed with Avrakatos and his argument.
"I don't care if you lose them all, just so long as one Soviet helicopter is shot down. If it takes $10 million worth of Erlikons to shoot down one $10 million Hind, that's a good investment. And if you shoot down two, you're way ahead," he said.
Gust found himself agreeing with the argument. In fact, he found himself secretly agreeing with almost everything Wilson was saying. At one point, Kogan slipped and told Wilson that the Erlikon just cost too much, and he wanted to use the money for other things.
"You either buy these cannons or you take that money and stick it up your ass," Wilson said.
But Kogan wouldn't back off. It became clear to Wilson that he was up against something far bigger than Chuck Kogan. In any other year, he would have gone to the mats immediately. But an old politician's instinct told him that Kogan, the agency, Stillwell, and all the others were just waiting him out. They read the papers, and the headlines about his upcoming primary said it all. "Good Time Charlie in Trouble. Wilson's Lifestyle Tests Supporters. Shenanigans Could Cost Representative Wilson." For the first time since he had come to Congress in 1973, he was in trouble at home. His all-forgiving constituents were reconsidering the blind support they had always offered their playboy congressman. A collection of Democratic challengers smelled blood, and so, Wilson suspected, did the CIA.